excite or blunt trauma. Calla was the first to speak. She flipped the three of swords around for the man to look at. On her card, the three swords stabbed into a dark, bleeding heart the color of her lips. "You've lost someone close to you." The man looked at his hands. "I have lost," he started, then considered before finishing. "Many things." Mora pursed her lips. One of Calla's eyebrows edged toward her hair. They darted glances at each other. Blue knew them both well enough to interpret the looks. Mora's asked, "What do you think?" Calla said, "This is off." Persephone said nothing. Mora touched the edge of the five of pentacles. "Money's a concern," she noted. On her card, a man with a crutch limped through snow under a stained glass window, while a woman held a shawl beneath her chin. She added, "Because of a woman?" The man's gaze was unflinching.
"My parents had considerable resources. My father was implicated in a business scandal. Now they're divorced and there is no money. Not for me."
It was a strangely unpleasant way to put it. Relentlessly factual. Mora wiped her palms on her slacks. She gestured to another card. "And now you're in a tedious job. It's something you're good at, but tired of." His lips were thin with the truth of it. Persephone touched the first card she had drawn, the Knight of Pentacles. An armored man with cold eyes surveyed a field from the back of a horse, a coin in his hand. Blue thought if she looked closely at the coin, she could see a shape in it. Three curving lines, a long-beaked triangle. The shape from the churchyard, from Mora's unmindful drawing, from the journal. But no, when she looked harder, it was just a faintly drawn five-pointed star, the pentacle for which the card was named. Persephone finally spoke. In her small, precise voice, she told the man, "You're looking for something." The man's head jerked toward her. Calla's card, beside Persephone's, was also the Knight of Pentacles. It was unusual for two decks to agree exactly. Even stranger was to see that Mora's card was also the Knight of Pentacles. Three cold-eyed knights surveyed the land before them. Three again. Calla said bitterly,
"You're willing to do whatever it takes to find it. You've been working at it for years."
"Yes," the man snapped, surprising them all with the ferocity of his response. "But how much longer will I find it?" The three women scanned the cards again, looking for an answer to his question. Blue looked too. She might not have had the sight, but she knew what the cards were supposed to mean. Her attention moved from the tower, which meant his life was about to change dramatically, to the last card in the reading, the Page of Cups. Blue glanced at her frowning mother. It wasn't that the Page of Cups was a negative card. In fact, it was the card Mora always said she thought represented Blue when she was doing a reading for herself. "You're the Page of Cups," Mora had told her once. "Look at all that potential she holds in that cup. Look, she even looks like you." And there was not just one Page of Cups in this reading. Like the Knight of Pentacles, it was tripled. Three young people holding a cup full of potential, all wearing Blue's face. Mora's expression was dark, dark, dark. Blue's skin prickled. Suddenly she felt as if there was no end to the fates she was tied to. Ganzi, Adam, that unseeable place in Neve's scrying bowl, this strange man sitting beside her. Her pulse was racing. Mora stood up so quickly that her chair keeled back against the wall. "The reading's done," she snapped. Persephone's gaze wandered up to Mora's face, bewildered, and Calla looked confused but delighted at the appearance of conflict. Blue didn't recognize her mother's face.
"Excuse me?" the man asked. "The other cards?"
"You heard her," Calla said, all acid.
Blue didn't know if Calla was also uneasy, or if she was merely backing Mora up.
"The reading's over."
"Get out of my house," Mora said, then with an obvious attempt at solicitude. "Now, thank you. Goodbye."
Calla moved aside for Mora to whirl past her to the front door. Mora pointed over the threshold. Rising to his feet, the man said,
"I'm incredibly insulted."
Mora didn't reply. As soon as he was clear of the doorway, she slammed the door shut behind him. The dishes in the cupboards rattled once again. Calla had moved to the window. She drew the curtains aside and leaned her forehead against the glass to watch him leave. Mora paced back and forth beside the table. Blue thought of asking a question, then stopped, then started again, then stopped. It seemed wrong to ask a question if no one else was. Persephone said,
"What an unpleasant young man."
Calla let the curtains drift shut. She remarked, "I got his license plate number."
"I hope he never finds what he's looking for," Mora said. Retrieving her two cards from the table, Persephone said a little regretfully,
"He's trying awfully hard. I rather think he'll find something."
Mora whirled toward Blue. "Blue, if you ever see that man again, you just walk the other way."
"No," Calla corrected. "Kick him in the nuts, then run the other way."
14. Helen, Gansey's older sister, called right as Gansey got to the parish's dirt road. Accepting phone calls in the pig was always tricky. The Camaro was a stick shift to start with and as loud as a semi-truck to end with, and in between those two things were a host of steering problems, electrical interferences, and grimy gear shift knobs. The upshot was that Helen was barely audible and Gansey nearly drove into the ditch.
"When is Mom's birthday?" Helen asked.
Gansey was simultaneously pleased to hear her voice and annoyed to be bothered by something so trivial. For the most part, he and his sister got along well. Gansey's siblings were a rare and complicated species, and they didn't have to pretend to be something they weren't around each other. "You're the wedding planner," Gansey said as a dog ripped out of nowhere. It barked furiously, trying to bite the Camaro's tires. "Shouldn't dates be your realm of expertise?"
"That means you don't remember," Helen replied. "And I'm not a wedding planner anymore. Well, part-time. Well, full-time, but not every day."
Helen did not need to be anything. She didn't have careers. She had hobbies that involved other people's lives.
"I do remember," he said tensely. "It's May 10th. A lab mix tied in front of the first house bayed dolorously as he passed. The other dog continued to worry at his tires, a snarl ascending with the engine note. Three kids in sleeveless shirts stood in one of the yards shooting milk jugs with BB guns. They shouted, 'Hey, Hollywood!' and affably aimed guns at the pig's tires. They pretended to hold phones by their ears. Gansey felt a peculiar stab at the three of them, their camaraderie, their belonging, products of their surroundings. He wasn't sure if it was pity or envy. Everywhere was dust."
Helen asked, "Where are you? You sound like you're on the set of a Guy Ritchie movie."
"I'm going to see a friend."
"The mean one or the white trash one?"
"Helen,"
she replied. "Sorry, I meant Captain Frigid or Trailer Park Boy."
"Helen." Adam didn't live in a trailer park, technically, since every house was a double-wide. Adam had told him that the last of the single-wide trailers had been taken out a few years ago, but he had said it ironically, like even he knew that doubling the size of the trailers didn't change much.
"Dad calls them worse things," Helen said. "Mom said one of your weird New Age books was delivered to the house yesterday. Are you coming home any time soon?"
"Maybe," Gansey said.
Somehow seeing his parents always reminded him of how little he'd accomplished, how similar he and Helen were, how many red ties he owned, how he was slowly growing up to be everything Ronan was afraid of becoming. He pulled in front of the light blue double-wide where the parishes lived.
"Maybe for Mom's birthday. I have to go. Things might get ugly."
The cell phone speaker made Helen's laugh a hissing, pitchless thing. "Listen to you, sounding all badass. I bet you're just listening to a CD called The Sounds of Crime while you cruise for chicks outside the Old Navy in your Camaro."
"Bye, Helen," said Gansey. He clicked end and climbed out.
Fat, shiny carpenter bees swooped at his head, distracted from their work of destroying the stairs. After he knocked, he looked out across the flat, ugly field of dead grass. The idea that you had to pay for the beauty in Henrietta should have occurred to him before then, but it hadn't. No matter how many times Adam told him he was foolish about money, he couldn't seem to get any wiser about it. "There is no spring here," Gansey realized, and the thought was unexpectedly grim. Adam's mother answered his knock. She was a shadow of Adam, the same elongated features, the same wide-set eyes. In comparison to Gansey's mother, she seemed old and hard-edged.
"Adam's out back," she said before he could ask her anything.
She glanced to him and away, not holding his gaze. Gansey never failed to be amazed at how Adam's parents reacted to the Aglenby sweater. They knew everything they needed to about him before he even opened his mouth. "Thanks," Gansey said, but the word felt like sawdust in his mouth, and in any case she was already closing the door. Under the old carport behind the house, he found Adam lying beneath an old Bonneville pulled up onto ramps, initially invisible in the cool blue shadows. An empty oil pan protruded from under the car. There was no sound coming from beneath the car, and Gansey suspected that Adam wasn't working so much as avoiding being in the house. "Hey, Tiger," Gansey said. Adam's knees bent as if he were going to scoot himself out from under the car, but then he didn't.
"What's up?" he said flatly.
Gansey knew what this meant, this failure to immediately come out from beneath the car, and anger and guilt drew his chest tight. The most frustrating thing about the Adam situation was that Gansey couldn't control it, not a single piece of it. He dropped a notebook on the work table. "Those are notes from today. I couldn't tell them you were sick. You missed too much last month." Adam's voice was even.
"What did you tell them then?"
One of the tools under the car made a half-hearted scraping sound. "Come on, Parrish. Come out," Gansey said. "Get it over with." Gansey jumped as a cold dog nose shoved into his dangling palm, the mutt that had so savagely attacked his tires earlier. He reluctantly fondled one of her stumpy ears and then jerked his hand back as she leapt at the car, barking at Adam's feet when they started to move. The ripped knees of Adam's camo cargo pants appeared first, then his faded Coca-Cola t-shirt, then finally his face. A bruise spread over his cheekbone, red and swelling as a galaxy. A darker one snaked over the bridge of his nose. Gansey said immediately, "You're leaving with me."
"It will only make it worse when I come back," Adam told him.
"I mean for good. Move into Monmouth. Enough's enough." Adam stood up. The dog pranced delightedly around his feet as if he'd been gone to another planet instead of merely underneath the car. Wearily, he asked,
"And what about when Glendower takes you away from Henrietta?"
Gansey couldn't say it wouldn't happen. "You come with."
"I come with? Tell me how that would work. I lose all the work I put in at Aglenby. I have to play the game again at another school."
Adam had once told Gansey, "Rags to riches isn't a story anyone wants to hear until after it's done." But it was a story that was hard to finish when Adam had missed school yet again. There was no happy ending without passing grades. Gansey said, "You wouldn't have to go to a school like Aglenby. It doesn't have to be an Ivy League. There are different ways to be successful." At once Adam said, "I don't judge you for what you do, Gansey." And this was an uneasy place to be, because Gansey knew it took a lot for Adam to accept his reasons for chasing Glendower. Adam had plenty of reasons to be indifferent about Gansey's nebulous anxiety, his questioning of why the universe had chosen him to be born to affluent parents, wondering if there was some greater purpose that he was alive. Gansey knew he had to make a difference, had to make a bigger mark on the world because of the head start he'd been given, or he was the worst sort of person out there. "The poor are sad they're poor," Adam had once mused, "and turns out the rich are sad they're rich." And Ronan had said, "Hey, I'm rich, and it doesn't bother me." Out loud, Gansey said, "Fine, then. We'd find another good school. We play the game. We make up a new life for you." Adam reached past him to find a rag and began to wipe between each greasy finger.
"I would have to find jobs, too. This didn't happen overnight. Do you know how long it took me to find these?
He didn't mean working in the carport outside his father's double-wide. That was merely a chore. Adam held down three jobs, the most important of which was at the trailer factory just outside Henrietta. I could cover you until you found something. There was a very long silence as Adam continued scrubbing his fingers. He didn't look up at Gansey. This was a conversation they'd had before, and entire days of arguments were replayed in the few moments of quiet. The words had been said often enough that they didn't need to be said again. Success meant nothing to Adam if he hadn't done it for himself. Gansey tried his best to keep his voice even, but a bit of heat crept in. "So you won't leave because of your pride. He'll kill you. You've watched too many cop shows."
"I've watched the evening news, Adam," Gansey snapped. "Why don't you let Ronan teach you to fight? He's offered twice now. He means it."
With great care, Adam folded the greasy rag and draped it back over a toolbox. There was a lot of stuff in the carport. New tool racks and calendars of topless women and heavy-duty air compressors and other things Mr. Parrish had decided were more valuable than Adam's school uniform. "Because then he will kill me."
"I don't follow," Adam said.
"He has a gun." Gansey said, "Christ." Laying a hand on the mutt's head, it drove her insane with happiness. Adam leaned out of the carport to look down the dirt road. He didn't have to tell Gansey what he was watching for.
"Come on, Adam," said Gansey.
"Please. We'll make it work." A wrinkle formed between Adam's eyebrows as he looked away. Not at the double wides in the foreground, but past them, to the flat, endless field with its tufts of dry grass. "So many things survived here without really living," he said.
"It means I never get to be my own person. If I let you cover for me, then I'm yours. I'm his now, and then I'll be yours."
It struck Gansey harder than he thought it would. Some days, all that grounded him was the knowledge that he and Adam's friendship existed in a place that money couldn't influence. Anything that spoke to the contrary hurt Gansey more than he would have admitted out loud. With precision, he asked, "Is that what you think of me?"
"You don't know, Gansey," Adam said. "You don't know anything about money, even though you've got all of it. You don't know how it makes people look at me and at you. It's all they need to know about us. They'll think I'm your monkey."
"I am only my money. It is all anyone sees, even Adam." Gansey shot back. "You think your plans are going to keep working when you miss school and work because you let your dad pound the shit out of you? You're as bad as her. You think you deserve it." Without warning, Adam slammed a small box of nails off the ledge beside him. The sound it made on the concrete startled both of them. Adam turned his back to Gansey, his arms crossed.
"Don't pretend you know," he said. "Don't come here and pretend you know anything."
Gansey told himself to walk away, to say nothing else. Then he said, "Don't pretend you have anything to be proud of, then." As soon as he said it, he knew that it wasn't fair. Or even if it had been fair, it wasn't right. But he wasn't sorry he'd said it. He went back to the Camaro and took his phone out to call Ronan, but the cell signal had completely disappeared like it often did in Henrietta. Usually Gansey took that as a sign that something supernatural was affecting the energy around the town, knocking down the cell signal and sometimes even the electricity. Now, he thought it probably just meant he wasn't getting through to anyone. Closing his eyes, he thought about the bruise on Adam's face, with its spreading soft edges and the hard red mark over his nose. He imagined coming here one day and finding that Adam wasn't here, but in the hospital, or worse, that Adam was here, but that something important had been beaten out of him. Even imagining it made him feel sick. The car jerked then, and Gansey's eyes came open as the passenger door groaned.
"Wait, Gansey," Adam said, out of breath. He was all folded over to be able to see inside the car. His bruise looked ghastly. It made his skin seem transparent.
"Don't leave, like..." Sliding his hands off the wheel and into his lap, Gansey peered up at him. This was the part where Adam was going to tell him not to take what he'd said personally.
but it felt personal. I'm only trying to help. I know, Adam told him. I know, but I can't do it that way. I can't live with myself that way. Gansey didn't understand, but he nodded. He wanted it to be over. He wanted it to be yesterday, when he and Ronan and Adam were listening to the recorder and Adam's face was still unmarked. Behind Adam, he saw the figure of Mrs. Parrish watching from the porch. Adam closed his eyes for a minute. Gansey could see his irises moving underneath the thin skin of his eyelids, a dreamer awake. And then, in one easy movement, he'd slid into the passenger seat. Gansey's mouth opened to form a question he didn't ask. "Let's go," Adam said. He didn't look at Gansey. His mother stared at them from the porch, but he didn't look at her either. "The psychic was the plan, right? We're doing the plan." "Yes, but I need to be back by 10. Now Adam looked at Gansey. There was something fierce and chilling in his eyes, an unnameable something that Gansey was always afraid would eventually take over completely. This, he knew, was a compromise, a risky gift that he could choose to reject. After a moment of hesitation, Gansey bumped knuckles with him over the gear shift. Adam rolled down the window and gripped the roof as if he needed to hold on. As the Camaro headed slowly out of the single-track road, their path was blocked by a blue Toyota pickup truck approaching from the other way. Adam's breath stopped audibly. Through the windshield, Gansey met the eyes of Adam's father. Robert Parrish was a big thing, colorless as August, grown from the dust that surrounded the trailers. His eyes were dark and small, and Gansey could see nothing of Adam in them. Robert Parrish spit out the window. He didn't pull over for them to pass. Adam's face was turned out to the cornfield, but Gansey didn't look away. "You don't have to come," said Gansey, because he had to say it. Adam's voice came from far away. "I'm coming." Jerking the wheel of the car, Gansey revved the engine up high. The pig stormed off the road, clouds of dirt exploding from the tires, and slammed through the shallow ditch. His heart thudded with anticipation and danger and the desire to shout everything he thought about Adam's father to Adam's father. As they charged back onto the driveway on the other side of the Toyota, Gansey could feel Robert Parrish's stare follow them. The weight of that gaze seemed like a more substantial promise of the future than anything a psychic might tell him. 15. Of course Gansey was not on time for his reading. The appointment time came and went. No Gansey. And perhaps more disappointingly, no phone call from Adam. Blue pulled aside the curtains to glance up and down the street, but there was nothing but normal after-work traffic. Maura made excuses. "Maybe he wrote down the wrong time," she said. Blue didn't think he'd written down the wrong time. 10 more minutes slouched by. Maura said, "Maybe he had car trouble." Blue didn't think he had car trouble. Calla retrieved the novel she'd been reading and started upstairs. Her voice carried down toward them. "That reminds me, you need to get that belt looked at on the Ford. I see a breakdown in your future. Next to that sketchy furniture store, a very ugly man with a cell phone will stop and be overly helpful." It was possible she really did see a breakdown in Mora's future, but it was also possible she was being hyperbolic. In any case, Maura made a note on the calendar. "Maybe I accidentally told him tomorrow afternoon instead of today," Maura said. Persephone murmured,
"That is always possible," and said, "Perhaps I will make a pie."
Blue looked anxiously to Persephone. Pie-making was a lengthy and loving process, and Persephone did not like to be interrupted during it. She wouldn't begin a pie if she really thought Gansey's arrival would interrupt her. Maura eyed Persephone as well before retrieving a bag of yellow squash and a stick of butter from the fridge. Now Blue knew precisely how the rest of the day was going to go. Persephone would make something sweet, Maura would make something with butter. Eventually Calla would reappear and make something involving sausage or bacon. It was how every evening went if a meal hadn't been planned in advance.
Blue didn't think that Mora had told Gansey tomorrow afternoon instead of today. What she thought was that Gansey had looked at the clock on his Mercedes-Benz's dashboard or Aston Martin's radio and had decided that the reading interfered with his rock climbing or racquetball. And then he'd blown it off, just like Adam had blown off calling her. She couldn't really be surprised. They'd done exactly what she expected from Raven Boys. Just as Blue was getting ready to sulk upstairs with her needles and her homework, Orla howled from the phone room, her wordless wail eventually resolving itself into words. "There is a 1973 Camaro in front of the house. It matches my nails." The last time Blue had seen Orla's nails, they'd been a complicated paisley pattern. She wasn't exactly sure what a 1973 Camaro looked like, but she was sure that if it was paisley, it must be impressive. She was also certain that Orla must be on the phone or she would have been down here ogling. "Well, here we go," Mora said, abandoning her squash in the sink. Calla reappeared in the kitchen, exchanging a sharp look with Persephone. Blue's stomach dropped to her feet. "Gansey, that's all there is." The doorbell rang.
"Are you ready?" Calla asked Blue.
Gansey was the boy she either killed or fell in love with, or both. There was no being ready. There just was this, Mora opening the door. There were three boys in the doorway, backlit by the evening sun as Neve had been so many weeks ago. Three sets of shoulders, one square, one built, one wiry. "Sorry that I'm late," said the boy in front with the square shoulders. The scent of mint rolled in with him, just as it had in the churchyard. "Will it be a problem?" Blue knew that voice. She reached for the railing of the stairs to keep her balance as President's cell phone stepped into the hallway. "Oh no, not him." All this time she'd been wondering how Gansey might die, and it turned out she was going to strangle him. At Nino's, the blare of the music had drowned out the finer points of his voice, and the odor of garlic had overwhelmed the scent of mint. But now that she put two and two together, it seemed obvious. In their hallway, he looked slightly less presidential, but only because the heat had made him messily roll up the sleeves of his button-down shirt and remove his tie. His dusty brown hair was mussed, too, in that way that Virginia warmth always managed. But the watch was still there, large enough to knock out bank robbers, and he still had that handsome glow. The glow that meant that not only had he never been poor, but his father hadn't, nor his father's father, nor his father's father's father. She couldn't tell if he was actually tremendously good-looking or merely tremendously wealthy. Perhaps they were the same thing. Gansey. This was Gansey. And that meant that the journal belonged to him. That meant that Adam belonged to him. "Well," Mora said. It was clear her curiosity overruled all rules of scheduling. "It's not too late. Come into the reading room. Can I get some names?" Because, of course, President's cell phone had brought most of his posse from Nino's, everyone but the smudgy boy. They filled the hallway to overflowing somehow, the three of them, loud and male and so comfortable with one another that they allowed no one else to be comfortable with them. They were a pack of sleek animals, armored with their watches and their topsiders and the expensive cut of their uniforms. Even the sharp boy's tattoo, cutting up the knobs of his spine above his collar, was a weapon, somehow slicing at Blue. "Gansey," President's cell phone said again, pointing to himself. "Adam? Ronan? Where do you want us? There?" He pointed a hand toward the reading room, palm flat, like he was directing traffic. "In there," Mora agreed. "This is my daughter, by the way. She'll be present for the reading, if you don't mind." Gansey's eyes found Blue. He'd been smiling politely, but now his face froze in the middle of the smile. "Hi again," he said. "This is awkward." "You've met?" Mora shot a poisonous look at Blue. Blue felt unfairly persecuted. "Yes," Gansey replied with dignity. "We had a discussion about alternative professions for women.
I didn't realize she was your daughter. Adam? He shot a nearly as poisonous look at Adam, whose eyes were large.
Adam was the only one not in uniform, and his palm was spread across his chest, as if his fingers would cover his faded Coca-Cola T-shirt.
I didn't know either, Adam said.
If Blue had known he was coming, she might not have worn her baby blue top with the feathers sewn into the collar. He was staring at it. To Blue, he said again,
I didn't know. I swear.
What happened to your face? Blue asked.
Adam shrugged ruefully. Either he or Ronan smelled like a parking garage. His voice was self-deprecating.
Do you think it makes me look tougher?
What it did make him look was more fragile and dirty somehow, like a teacup unearthed from the soil. But Blue didn't say that.
Ronan said,
It makes you look like a loser.
Ronan, said Gansey.
I need everyone to sit down, shouted Mora.
It was such an alarming thing to hear Mora shout that nearly everyone did, sinking or throwing themselves into the mismatched furniture in the reading room. Adam rubbed a hand over his cheekbone as if he could remove the bruise from it. Gansey sat in an armchair at the head of the table, his hands stretched over either arm like chairman of the board, one eyebrow raised as he looked at Steve Martin's framed face. Only Calla and Ronan remained standing, and they regarded each other warily. It still felt like there had never been this many people in the house, which was utterly untrue. It was possibly true that there had never been this many men in the house before. Certainly never this many Raven boys. Blue felt as if their very presence robbed something from her. They'd made her family dingy just by coming here.
It is, Mora said, too damn loud in here.
The way she said it, though, holding one finger to her pulse just under her jawbone, told Blue that it was not their voices that were too loud. It was something she was hearing inside her head. Persephone, too, was wincing.
Do I need to leave? Blue asked,
though that was the last thing she wanted. Gansey, misunderstanding, immediately asked her,
Why would you have to leave?
She makes things louder for us, Mora said.
She was frowning over all of them, as if she was trying to make sense of it.
And you three are very loud already.
Blue's skin was hot. She could imagine herself heating like an electrical conduit, sparks from all parties traveling through her. What could these Raven boys have going on under their skins that could deafen her mother? Was it all of them in conjunction, or was it merely Gansey, his energy screaming out the countdown to his death?
What do you mean, very loud? Gansey asked.
He was, Blue thought, very clearly the ringleader of this little pack. They all kept looking to him for their cues of how to interpret the situation.
I mean that there is something about your energies that is very...
Mora trailed off, losing interest in her own explanation. She turned to Persephone. Blue recognized the look exchanged between them. It was,
What is going on? How do we even do this?
The way she asked it, distracted and vague, made Blue's stomach clench with nerves. Her mother was undone. For the second time, a reading seemed to be pushing her to a place she wasn't comfortable with.
One at a time?
Persephone suggested, her voice nearly inaudible. Calla said,
One-offs. You'll have to, or some of them will have to leave. They're just too noisy.
Adam and Gansey glanced at each other. Ronan picked at the leather straps around his wrist.
What is a one-off? Gansey asked. How is it different from a regular reading?
Calla spoke to Mora as if he hadn't said anything at all. It doesn't matter what they want. It is what it is. Take it or leave it.
Mora's finger was still pressed under her jaw. She told Gansey, A one-off is where you each draw just one card from a deck of tarot cards and we interpret. Gansey and Adam shared some sort of private conversation with their eyes. It was the sort of thing Blue was used to transpiring between her mother and Persephone or Calla, and she hadn't thought anyone else really capable of it. It also made her feel strangely jealous. She wanted something like that, a bond strong enough to transcend words.
Adam's head jerked a nod in response to whatever Gansey's unspoken statement might have been, and Gansey said, "Whatever you're comfortable with." Persephone and Mora momentarily debated, though it didn't seem like they'd be comfortable with anything at the moment.
"Wait,"
Persephone said as Mora produced her deck of cards.
"Have Blue deal it."
It wasn't the first time Blue had been asked to deal the cards. Sometimes, at difficult or important readings, the women wanted Blue to touch the deck first, to hone whatever messages the cards might contain. This time, she was overly aware of the boy's attention as she took the cards from her mother. For the boy's benefit, she shuffled the deck in a slightly theatrical fashion, moving cards from one hand to another. She was very good at card tricks that didn't involve any psychic talent whatsoever. As the boys, impressed, watched the cards fly back and forth, Blue mused that she would make an excellent fake psychic. No one volunteered immediately to go first, so she offered the deck to Adam. He met her gaze and held it for a moment. There was something forceful and intentional about the gesture, more aggressive than he'd been the night he approached her. Selecting a card, Adam presented it to Mora.
"Two of Swords," she said.
Blue was over-aware of her mother's Henrietta accent, suddenly rural and uneducated sounding to her ear. Was that how Blue sounded?
Mora continued, "You're avoiding a hard choice, acting by not acting. You're ambitious, but you feel like someone's asking something of you you're not willing to give, asking you to compromise your principles. Someone close to you, I think. Your father?"
"Brother, I think,"
Persephone said.
"I don't have a brother, ma'am,"
Adam replied, but Blue saw his eyes dart to Gansey.
"Do you want to ask a question?"
Mora asked. Adam considered. "What's the right choice?"
Mora and Persephone conferred.
Mora replied, "There isn't a right one, just one you can live with. There might be a third option that will suit you better, but right now, you're not seeing it because you're so involved with the other two. I'd guess, from what I'm seeing, that any other path would have to do with you going outside those other two options and making your own option. I'm also sensing you're a very analytical thinker. You've spent a lot of time learning to ignore your emotions, but I don't think this is a time for that."
"Thanks," Adam said. It wasn't quite the right thing to say, but it wasn't entirely wrong either. Blue liked how polite he was. It seemed different than Gansey's politeness. When Gansey was polite, it made him powerful. When Adam was polite, he was giving power away. It seemed right to leave Gansey for last, so Blue moved on to Ronan, though she was a little afraid of him. Something about him dripped venom, even though he hadn't spoken. Worst of all, in Blue's opinion, was that there was something about his antagonism that made her want to court his favor, to earn his approval. The approval of someone like him, who clearly cared for no one, seemed like it would be worth more. To offer the deck to Ronan, Blue had to stand, because he still stood by the doorway near Calla. They looked ready to box. When Blue fanned the cards, he scanned the women in the room and said, "I'm not taking one. Tell me something true first."
"Beg your pardon," Calla said stiffly, answering for Mora. Ronan's voice was glass, cold and brittle. "Everything you've told him could apply to anybody. Anybody with a pulse has doubts. Anybody alive has argued with their brother or their father. Tell me something no one else can tell me. Don't toss a playing card at me and spoon-feed me some Jungian bullshit. Tell me something specific." Blue's eyes narrowed. Persephone stuck out her tongue slightly, a habit born of uncertainty, not impudence. Mora shifted with annoyance.
"We don't do specific,"
Calla interrupted. "A secret killed your father, and you know what it was." The room went deadly silent. Both Persephone and Mora were staring at Calla. Gansey and Adam were staring at Ronan. Blue was staring at Calla's hand. Mora often called on Calla to do joint tarot readings, and Persephone sometimes called on her to interpret her dreams, but very rarely did anyone ask Calla to use one of her strangest gifts, psychometry.
Calla had an uncanny ability to hold an object and sense its origin, feel its owner's thoughts, and see places the thing had been. Now Calla pulled her hand away. She'd reached to touch Ronan's tattoo right where it met his collar. His face was turned just slightly, looking to where her fingers had been. There might have only been Ronan and Calla in the room. He was a head taller than her already, but he looked young beside her, like a lanky wildcat not yet up to weight. She was a lioness. She hissed, "What are you?" Ronan's smile chilled blue. There was something empty in it. "Ronan?" Gansey asked, concern in his voice. "I'm waiting in the car." Without further comment, Ronan left, slamming the door hard enough that the dishes in the kitchen rattled. Gansey turned an accusatory gaze on Calla. "His father's dead." "I know," Calla said. Her eyes were slits. Gansey's voice was cordial enough to pass straight through polite and on to rude. "I don't know how you found out, but that's a pretty lousy thing to throw at a kid."
"At a snake, you mean," Calla snarled back. "And what is it you came for if you didn't believe we could do what we're charging you for? He asked for a specific. I gave him a specific. I'm sorry it wasn't puppies."
"Calla," Morris said, at the same time that Adam said, "Gansey." Adam murmured something directly into Gansey's ear and then leaned back. A bone moved at Gansey's jawline. Blue saw him shift back into President's cell phone. She hadn't been aware before that he'd been anything else. Now she wished she'd been paying better attention so she could have seen what was different about him. Gansey said, "I'm sorry. Ronan is blunt, and he wasn't comfortable coming here in the first place. I wasn't trying to insinuate that you were less than genuine. Can we continue?" He sounded so old, Blue thought, so formal in comparison to the other boys he'd brought. There was something intensely discomforting about him, akin to how she felt compelled to impress Ronan. Something about Gansey made her feel so strongly other that it was as if she had to guard her emotions against him. She could not like him, or whatever it was about these boys that drowned out her mother's psychic abilities and filled the room to overflowing would overwhelm her. "You're fine," Mora said, though she looked at glowering Calla when she said it. As Blue moved to where Gansey sat, she caught a glimpse of his car at the curb. A flash of impossible orange, the sort of orange Orla would definitely paint her nails. It was not exactly what she'd have expected an Aglinby boy to drive. They liked new, shiny things, and this was an old, shiny thing. But it was clearly a Raven boy's car, nonetheless. And just then, Blue had a falling sensation, like things were happening too fast for her to properly absorb them. There was something odd and complicated about all of these boys, Blue thought. Odd and complicated in the way that the journal was odd and complicated. Their lives were somehow a web, and she had somehow managed to do something to get herself stuck in the very edge of it. Whether that something had been done in the past or was going to be done in the future seemed irrelevant. In this room with Mora and Calla and Persephone, time felt circular. She stopped in front of Gansey. This close, she again caught the scent of mint, and that made Blue's heart trip unsteadily. Gansey looked down at the fan deck of cards in her hands. When she saw him like that, she saw the bend of his shoulders and the back of his head, and she piercingly remembered his spirit, the boy she'd been afraid she'd fall in love with. That shade hadn't worn any of the effortless, breezy confidence of this Raven boy in front of her. "What happens to you, Gansey?" she wondered. "When do you become that person?" Gansey looked up at her, and there was a crease between his eyebrows. "I don't know how to choose. Could you pick a card for me? Will that work?" Out of the corner of her eye, Blue saw Adam shifting in his chair, frowning. Persephone answered from behind Blue.
"If you wanted to."
"It's about intention," Mora added. "I want you to," he said. "Please." Blue fanned the cards across the table. They slithered loosely over the finish. She let her fingers float above them. Once,
Maura had told her that the correct cards sometimes felt warm or tingly when her fingers were near them. For Blue, of course, each card felt identical. One, however, had slid farther than the others, and that was the one she chose. As she flipped it over, she let out a little helpless laugh. The Page of Cups looked back at Blue with her own face. It felt like someone was laughing at her, but she had no one to blame for the selection of the card but herself. When Maura saw it, her voice went still and remote. "Not that one. Make him choose another."
"Maura,"
said Persephone mildly, but Maura just waved her hand, dismissing her. "Another one," she insisted. "What's wrong with that one?" Gansey asked. "It has Blue's energy on it," Maura said. "It wasn't meant to be yours. You'll have to pick it yourself." Persephone moved her mouth back and forth, but she didn't say anything. Blue replaced the card and shuffled the deck with less drama than before. When she offered the cards to him, Gansey turned his face away like he was pulling a raffle winner. His fingers grazed the edges of the cards, contemplative. He selected one, then flipped it over to show the room. It was the Page of Cups. He looked at the face on the card, and then at Blue's face, and Blue knew that he'd seen the similarity. Maura leaned forward and snatched the card from his fingers. "Pick another one." "Now why?" Gansey said. "What's wrong with that card? What does it mean?" "Nothing's wrong with it," Maura replied. "It's just not yours." Now, for the first time, Blue saw an edge of true aggravation to Gansey's expression, and it made her like him a little better. So there was something below the Raven Boy exterior, maybe. Flippantly, Gansey snagged another card, clearly finished with this exercise. With flourish, he turned the card over and slapped it on the table. Blue swallowed. Maura said, "That's your card." On the card on the table was a black knight astride a white horse. The knight's helmet was lifted so that it was obvious that his face was a bare skull, dominated by eyeless sockets. The sun set behind him, and below his horse's hooves lay a corpse. Outside the windows behind them, a breeze hissed audibly through the trees. "Death," Gansey read the bottom of the card. He didn't sound surprised or alarmed. He just read the word like he would read eggs or Cincinnati.
"Great job, Maura," Calla said. Her arms were crossed firmly over her chest. "You going to interpret that for the kid?"
"Possibly. We should just give him a refund,"
Persephone suggested, although Gansey had not paid yet.
"I thought that psychics didn't predict death," Adam said quietly. "I read that the death card was only symbolic."
Maura and Calla and Persephone all made vague noises. Blue, utterly aware of the truth of Gansey's fate, felt ill. Aglenby boy or not, he was only her age, and he obviously had friends who cared for him, and a life that involved a very orange car, and it was hideous to know he'd be dead in less than 12 months.
"Actually," Gansey said, "I don't care about that."
Every pair of eyes in the room was on him as he stood the card on its end to study it.
"I mean, the cards are very interesting," he said. He said the cards are very interesting, like someone would say, "This is very interesting to a very strange sort of cake that they didn't quite want to finish. And I don't want to discount what you do, but I didn't really come here to have my future told to me. I'm quite okay with finding that out for myself."
He cast a quick glance at Calla at this, obviously realizing that he was walking a fine line between polite and Ronan.
"Really, I came because I was hoping to ask you a question about energy," Gansey continued. "I know you deal with energy work, and I've been trying to find a ley line I think is near Henrietta. Do you know anything about that?"
"The journal."
"Ley line," Maura repeated.
"Maybe.
I don't know if I know it by that name. What is it?"
Blue was a little stunned. She'd always thought her mother was the most truthful person around. "They're straight energy lines that crisscross the globe," Gansey explained. "They're supposed to connect major spiritual places. Adam thought you might know about them because you deal with energy." It was obvious that he meant the corpse road,
but Mora didn't offer any information. She just pressed her lips together and looked at Persephone and Calla. "Does that ring a bell to you two?" Persephone pointed a finger straight in the air and then said,
"I forgot about my pie crust."
She withdrew from the room.
Calla said, "I'd have to think about it. I'm not good with specifics."
There was a faint, amused smile on Gazi's face that meant he knew they were lying. It was a strangely wise expression. Once again, Blue got the sense that he seemed older than the boys he'd brought with him.
"I'll look into it," Mora said. "If you leave your number, I can give you a call if I find out anything about it."
Gansey replied, coolly polite, "Oh, that's quite all right. How much for the reading?"
Standing, Mora said, "Oh, just 20.
Blue thought this was criminal. Gansey clearly had spent more than $20 on the laces for his topsiders. He frowned at Mora over the top of his open wallet. There were a lot of bills in it. They could have been ones, but Blue doubted it. She could also see his driver's license through a clear window, not closely enough to make out the details, but close enough to see that the name printed on it looked a lot longer than just Gansey.
20?
Each, Blue added. Calla coughed into her fist. Gansey's face cleared, and he handed Mora $60. Quite obviously, this was more what he'd been expecting to pay, and now the world was right again. It was Adam, though, who Blue noticed then. He was looking at her, sharp-eyed, and she felt transparent and guilty, not only about overcharging, but about Mora's lie. Blue had seen Gansey's spirit walk the corpse road, and she had known his name before he walked in this door. Like her mother, she'd said nothing, so she was complicit.
"I'll show you out," Mora said. She was clearly eager to see them on the other side of the door. For a moment, it looked as if Gansey felt the same, but then he stopped. He paid an undue amount of attention to his wallet as he folded it and reinserted it into his pocket, and then he looked up to Mora and made a firm line of his mouth.
"Look, we're all adults here," he started. Calla made a face as if she disagreed.
Gansey squared his shoulders and continued,
"So I think we deserve the truth. Tell me you know something, but you don't want to help me if that's what's going on. But don't lie to me." It was a brave thing to say, or an arrogant one, or maybe there was not enough of a difference between the two things to matter. Every head in the room swung to Mora. She said, "I know something, but I don't want to help you."
For the second time that day, Calla looked delighted. Blue's mouth was open. She closed it.
Gansey, however, just nodded, no more or less distressed than when Blue had retorted back to him at the restaurant.
"All right, then. No, you can stay put. We'll let ourselves out."
And just like that, they did, Adam sending Blue a last look that she couldn't easily interpret. A second later, the Camaro revved high, and the tires squealed out Gansey's true feelings. Then the house was quiet. It was a sucked-out silence, like the Raven boys had taken all the sound in the neighborhood with them.
Blue whirled on her mother.
"Mom!"
She was going to say something else, but all that she could manage was again louder. "Mom!"
"Mora," Calla said, "that was very rude." Then she added, "I liked it."
Mora turned to Blue as if Calla hadn't spoken. "I don't want you to ever see him again."
Indignant, Blue cried, "Whatever happened to children should never be given orders."
"That was before Gansey." Mora flipped around the death card, giving Blue a long time to stare at the skull inside the helmet. "This is the same as me telling you not to walk in front of a bus."
Several comebacks riffled through Blue's head before she found one that she wanted.
"Why? Neve didn't see me on the corpse road. I'm not going to die in the next year."
"First of all, the corpse road is a promise, not a guarantee," Mora replied. "Second of all, there are other terrible fates besides death. Shall we talk about dismemberment, paralysis, endless psychological trauma? There's something really wrong with those boys. When your mother says don't walk in front of a bus, she has a good reason."
From the kitchen, Persephone's soft voice called,
"If someone had stopped you from walking in front of a bus, Mora, Blue wouldn't be here.
Mora shot a frown in her direction, then swept her hand across the reading table as if she were clearing it of crumbs. The best case scenario here is that you make friends with a boy who is going to die.
Ah, said Calla in a very, very knowing way. Now I see.
Don't psychoanalyze me, her mother said.
I already have, and I say again, ah.
Mora sneered uncharacteristically and then asked Calla, what did you see when you touched that other boy? The Raven Boy.
They're all Raven Boys, Blue said.
Her mother shook her head. No, he's more Raven than the others.
Calla rubbed her fingertips together as if she was wiping the memory of Ronan's tattoo from them.
It's like scrying into that weird space. There's so much coming out of him it shouldn't be possible. Do you remember that woman who came in who was pregnant with quadruplets? It was like that, but worse.
He's pregnant? Blue asked.
He's creating, Calla said. That space is creating, too. I don't know how to say it any better than that.
Blue wondered what sort of creating they meant. She was always creating things, taking old things and cutting them up and making them better things, taking things that already existed and transforming them into something else. This, she felt, was what most people meant when they called someone creative. But she suspected that wasn't how Calla meant it. She suspected that what Calla meant was the true meaning of creative, to make a thing where before there was none. Mora caught Blue's expression. She said, I've never told you to do anything before, Blue, but I'm telling you now, stay away from them.
16. The night following the reading, Gansey woke to a completely unfamiliar sound and fumbled for his glasses. It sounded a little like one of his roommates was being killed by a possum, or possibly the final moments of a fatal catfight. He wasn't certain of the specifics, but he was sure death was involved. Noah stood in the doorway to his room, his face pathetic and long-suffering. Make it stop, he said. Ronan's room was sacred, and yet here Gansey was, twice in the same week, pushing the door open. He found the lamp on, and Ronan hunched on the bed, wearing only boxers. 6 months before, Ronan had gotten the intricate black tattoo that covered most of his back and snaked up his neck, and now the monochromatic lines of it were stark in the claustrophobic lamplight, more real than anything else in the room. It was a peculiar tattoo, both vicious and lovely. And every time Gansey saw it, he saw something different in the pattern. Tonight, nestled in an inked glen of wicked, beautiful flowers, was a beak where before he'd seen a scythe. The ragged sound cut through the apartment again. What fresh hell is this? Gansey asked pleasantly. Ronan was wearing headphones as usual, so Gansey stretched forward far enough to tug them down around his neck. Music wailed faintly into the air. Ronan lifted his head. As he did, the wicked flowers on his back shifted and hid behind his sharp shoulder blades. In his lap was the half-formed raven, its head tilted back, beak agape. I thought we were clear on what a closed door meant, Ronan said. He held a pair of tweezers in one hand. I thought we were clear that night was for sleeping. Ronan shrugged. Perhaps for you. Not tonight. Your pterodactyl woke me.
Why is it making that sound?
In response, Ronan dipped the tweezers into a plastic baggie on the blanket in front of him. Gansey wasn't certain he wanted to know what the gray substance was in the tweezers' grasp. As soon as the raven heard the rustle of the bag, it made the ghastly sound again, a rasping squeal that became a gurgle as it slurped down the offering. At once, it inspired both Gansey's compassion and his gag reflex. Well, this is not going to do, he said. You're going to have to make it stop.
She has to be fed, Ronan replied.
The raven gargled down another bite. This time it sounded a lot like vacuuming potato salad.
It's only every 2 hours for the first 6 weeks.
Can't you keep her downstairs?
In reply, Ronan half lifted the little bird toward him.
You tell me.
Gansey disliked having his kindness appealed to, especially when it had to war with his desire for sleep. There was, of course, no way that he would force the raven downstairs. It looked bite-sized and improbable. He wasn't certain if it was extremely cute or appallingly ugly, and it bothered him that it managed to be both. From behind him, Noah said, sounding pitiful, "I don't like that thing in here. It reminds me of..."
He trailed off, as he often did, and Ronan pointed the tweezers at him. "Hey, man, stay out of my room."
"Shut up," Gansey told both of them. "That includes you, Bird."
"Chainsaw."
Noah withdrew, but Gansey remained. For several minutes he watched the raven slurp down gray slime while Ronan cooed at her. He was not the Ronan that Gansey had grown accustomed to, but neither was he the Ronan that Gansey had first met. It was clear now that the instrument wailing from the headphones was the Irish pipes. Gansey couldn't remember the last time Ronan had listened to Celtic music. Neil Lynch's music. All at once he too missed Ronan's charismatic father. But more than that, he missed the Ronan that had existed when Neil Lynch had still been alive. This boy in front of him now, fragile bird in his hands, seemed like a compromise. After a space, Gansey asked, "What did the psychic mean, Ronan, earlier, about your father?" Ronan didn't lift his head, but Gansey watched the muscles in his back tighten, stretched as if they were suddenly carrying weight.
"That's a very Declan question."
Gansey considered this.
No, I don't think it is."
"She was just full of shit."
Gansey considered this too.
"No, I don't think she was." Ronan found his music player next to him on the bed and paused it. When he replied, his voice was pitchless and naked.
"She's one of those chicks who gets inside your head and fucks around with parts. She said it because she knew it would cause problems."
"Like what?"
"Like you asking me questions like Declan would," Ronan said.
He offered the raven another gray mass, but she just stared up at him, transfixed,
"making me think about things I don't want to think about. Those sorts of problems. Among others, what's going on with your face, by the way?"
Gansey rubbed his chin, rueful. His skin felt reluctantly stubbled. He knew he was being diverted, but he allowed it.
"Is it growing?" "Dude, you aren't really going to do that beard thing, are you? I thought you were joking. You know that stopped being cool in the 14th century or whenever it was that Paul Bunyan lived."
Ronan looked over his shoulder at him. He was sporting the 5 o'clock shadow that he was capable of growing at any time of the day.
"Just stop. You look mangy."
"It's irrelevant. It's not growing. I'm doomed to be a man-child."
"If you keep saying things like man-child, we're done," Ronan said.
"Hey, man, don't let it get you down. Once your balls drop, that beard'll come in great, like a fucking rug. You eat soup, it'll filter out the potatoes, terrier style. Do you have hair on your legs? I've never noticed."
Gansey didn't dignify any of this with a response. With a sigh, he pushed off the wall and pointed at the raven. "I'm going back to bed. Keep that thing quiet. You so owe me, Lynch."
"Whatever," Ronan said.
Gansey retreated to his bed, though he didn't lie down. He reached for his journal, but it wasn't there. He'd left it at Nino's the night of the fight. He thought about calling Mallory, but he didn't know what he wanted to ask. Something inside him felt like the night, hungry and wanting and black. He thought about the dark eye holes of the skeletal night on the death card. An insect was buzzing against the window, the sort of buzz tap that came from an insect with some size to it. He thought about his EpiPen, far away in the glove box of the car, too far away to be a useful antidote if it was needed. The insect was probably a fly or a stink bug or yet another crane fly, but the longer he lay there, the more he considered the idea that it could be a wasp or a bee. It probably wasn't. But he opened his eyes. Gansey climbed softly from the bed, bending to retrieve a shoe that lay on its side. Walking cautiously to the window, he searched for the sound of the insect.
The shadow of the telescope was an elegant monster on the floor beside him. Though the sound of buzzing had died away, it only took him a moment to find the insect on the window. A wasp, crawling up the narrow wooden frame of the window, swiveling back and forth. Gansey didn't move. He watched it climb and pause. The street lights outside made a faint shadow of its legs, its curved body, the fine, insubstantial point of the stinger. Two narratives coexisted in his head. One was the real image, the wasp climbing up the wood, oblivious to his presence. The other was a false image, a possibility. The wasp whirring into the air, finding Gansey's skin, dipping the stinger into him. Gansey's allergy, making it a deadly weapon. Long ago, his skin had crawled with hornets, their wings beating even when his heart hadn't. His throat was tight and full. Gansey. Ronan's voice was just behind him. The timbre of it strange and initially unrecognizable. Gansey didn't turn around. The wasp had just twitched its wings, nearly lifting off. "Shit, man," Ronan said. There were three footsteps very close together, the floor creaking like a shot, and then the shoe was snatched from Gansey's hand. Ronan shoved him aside and brought down the shoe on the window so hard that the glass should have broken. After the wasp's dry body had fallen to the floorboard, Ronan sought it out in the darkness and smashed it once more. "Shit," Ronan said again. "Are you stupid?" Gansey didn't know how to describe how it felt to see death crawling inches from him, to know that in a few seconds he could have gone from a promising student to beyond saving. He turned to Ronan, who had painstakingly picked up the wasp by a broken wing so that Gansey wouldn't step on it. "What did you want?" he asked. "What?" Ronan demanded. "You came out for something." Ronan chucked the wasp's small body into the wastebasket by the desk.